right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ Podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit Podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Your resume is just life. And that you can't believe what that checks you into. Places you can get into, where we wind up. I mean, come on. Back in the day when we were coming up, you know, thinking that we would be here talking about this, having gone through everything that we went through, pretty amazing, man. So,
are you cancer-free or are you still got it?
No, I've been stage four for the last year. And, you know, we can get into it a little bit because it's kind of part of the journey and what's kind of set us off to what we're doing. But yeah, it's weird. I've been stage four since last summer. And I started out with bone cancer, chondrosarcoma of my right leg, my hip and femur. So they removed my femur, probably about, I don't know, maybe half to three quarters of it in my hip.
So you got a rod in there now, or they take your whole leg?
Yeah, I almost did lose it because I didn't know I had it. And they misdiagnosed me right off the bat. You know, they said, we think, you know, I was feeling really good at the time. I was doing high risk protection for some celebrities for the last 5 years. And I was doing a lot of jujitsu, MMA, and I was lifting a lot. And thankfully, I didn't break my leg because my femur was highly compromised right at the femoral head. Ooh. And yeah, it was pretty compromised to the point where I was close to snapping it. And that would have been, I would have lost my leg then.
You probably would have bled out. But
yeah, it would have been bad. It would have been a bad day. And yeah, so I had, you know, I finally got a second opinion from, because a lot of the guys that I deployed with back in the day were getting these strange illnesses. And, you know, out of the original 30 of us that deployed back in 2003 to Iraq and subsequent tours, a lot of guys were getting these weird sicknesses. We had five ALS deaths, a lot of, I think there was three of them were team guys. And that's what prompted me. At first I didn't want to be conspiracy theorists. I was like, well, it's just, you know, life, you know, guys get sick, but everybody was really healthy guys that took care of themselves and really fit. And they were young, you know, maybe 40. Some of them were in their mid 30s when they started getting these illnesses. So that kind of prompted me. I said, man, this doesn't sound right. I don't think I have a bone infection. You know, I'm very careful what I, you know, how I train all the time. I eat right. And based on that, I got a second opinion. They said, yeah, man, you know, they did a bone graft first, and which wasn't really needed. They did a biopsy a week later. They said, yeah, dude, you know, you've got a very advanced form of chondrosarcoma, which is a subset of sarcoma. And that is less than 1% of all cancers. So it's pretty rare. And, you know, so after that, I had a bunch of surgeries, and then I got MRSA right after I had the surgery. I went right back to the gym like an idiot. And they were like, hey, that thing's got to come out. You know, you got MRSA. So 3 months of, I almost lost my leg again at the hip. But thankfully, everything, I caught it early enough, largely because of jujitsu. I knew what it looked like. You know, it was just a small spot. And my wife's a nurse. And I talked to her and I said, man, this doesn't look right. You know, let's go tomorrow.
But it was just present, like you had something on your, like a dark spot on your leg.
Yeah. I had about 120 staples on my second surgery. And it was like right on the incision. There was just a little red spot, you know, and I think most people probably would have missed it or just been like, well, it's part, you know, it's pretty gnarly surgery. So, you know, they probably wouldn't pay it much mind. And so I went in and they were like, same doctor that I got a second opinion from that saved me the first time. She was an infectious disease doctor, this fantastic woman. And she's like, yeah, I want to start you on Dapto like today. And if I had waited just a couple more days, I wouldn't have a leg, you know, at best case. So yeah, I got lucky.
Right. But the cancer still, I mean, does cancer spread throughout your body?
Yeah. So what happens is like, because it was a grade three chondrosarcoma.
Explain what that is.
So sarcomas account for less than 1% of all cancers. I have a subset of that. So it's less than 1% of 1%. And good based
for,
on the rarity.
Good for you, man.
That's badass. I mean, don't half-ass it. Well,
hey, way to go.
I'm kind of that guy, right? You know, like my story is interesting from the point of view that I don't do anything, you know, easy, right?
Like, you're on that long suffering team.
Yeah, I tell people I'm a professional sufferer. Right? You know,
I'm going
to
use. Yeah, that
I'm
one.
Very good at suffering. I like to keep a smile on my face as I'm going.
We should get badges.
Yeah, I would have a couple,
right?
But yeah, so that's what it is. I mean, it's basically a bone cancer, and the only way to remove it is to cut it out. So unfortunately, a lot of these, luckily for me, it was in my leg. There are some people that get it in their pelvis, their sternum, and they just got to remove all of it. You know, I've seen guys have some pretty crazy surgeries, like removing half of their pelvis and, things like that. So the first place this cancer metastasizes is your lungs. And so I knew that going in. And later on, maybe we can talk about mindset a little bit, but I always kind of prepare myself for the worst and hope for the best, right? It's just the way I compartmentalize and protect myself from like bad news coming down. So a grade three is like fairly advanced. I think my original diagnosis, I had about a 29% chance to live survival rate for 5 years. And I'm about 3 years in. So last year, I had a chest x-ray, CT, and a couple PET scans, and they found a couple of what they call suspicious nodules on my right lung. And of course I knew right away, I was like, well, that's lung cancer, because previous, all my scans that I had right when I had this, when they found out I had it in my leg, they were all clear. So I'm like, look, guys, this isn't rocket science. I'm like, you know, 47 years old at the time. And, you know, obviously I'm not a medical professional, but I knew right away, I was like, well, I have lung cancer. What can we do about it? And it was too dangerous to biopsy for all of last year. And then they found this new robot in the state of Georgia. There was only three people doing this. And so I went to a specialist. I had a lung biopsy in February of this year. And the surgeon ended up, it's called a bronchoscopy. They put it down your airway and you're on a ventilator for a couple hours. It looked like I got abducted by aliens. You know, there's like monitors everywhere, a team of 20 people. And I didn't ask enough, you know, questions. So for the audience, what I always tell people now, going through the situations that I've been through over the last 3 years, is you have to advocate for yourself. If you don't, you're not going to have good success rate, right? So the surgeons actually, when they went through a week later, he called me with the results, which I was hoping at that point, I was like, either way, it's going to be good news because it's something that I don't know today and we can get after it. And they missed, right? So I was like, what do you mean you missed? You missed the target? Like you had one job. I was a good patient, you know?
I wasn't moving around.
Yeah, I laid there and did my thing. But so that didn't give us any more information. But just about a month ago, I found a really good cancer specialist who basically diagnosed me based on all my history. I brought him in probably like 20 different CDs of PET scans, CAT scans, and MRIs. And he presented my case to a sarcoma board. And they're like, yeah, dude, you're right. You've been stage four for probably a year, if not longer, with no treatment. So we got to get after it. So that's kind of where I'm at now. I've been waiting for 2.5 months from the VA. They didn't take my private insurance as cancer specialist. So I had to wait 2.5 months to get approved through community care to get treatment. And I just got that 2 weeks ago. So last week I had a bunch of imaging done. And tomorrow I have a really big meeting with my doc to determine what the next steps are as far as like some sort of treatment. But unfortunately, with what I got, radiation doesn't work. Chemo doesn't typically work. So it's probably going to be more experimental on Hail Mary. You know, that's kind of what I think I'm looking at, but I'll know more tomorrow.
Prognosis of time? I mean, I know the Lord's always got a plan for everybody, but what are the docs saying?
I don't know. I mean, this stuff, if it goes untreated, it blows up in your lungs. Sometimes it's months, you know what I mean? And that's kind of the tricky part, you know, living this way for the last year, knowing that I wasn't doing anything about it other than just taking care of myself the best way I can. It's kind of a mind game, because if you dwell on that, you know, you tend not to be productive. But I kind of leveraged all this stuff for good, you know. I tried to kind of make good use of my time, which we'll get into with the documentary and stuff. It kind of pushed me to do good things for other people, you know?
Sure. I mean,
well, man, we'll definitely pray for you on that one. And if there's anybody that we have on our team that's listening, man, we'll get the word out.
Yeah. If there's anything you need that you can't get.
You said that the best, you got to be your own advocate, and they're asking, like, if you're, because you're a rarity. You're an anomaly, right?
Yeah. That's why my wife calls me a cockroach, you know?
Well,
she's like, man, this guy is stubborn. So, yeah, I think one of the things is, you know, when I talk about, you know, being a good advocate for yourself is when I first, going back to February of this year is a good example, right? So, like, I'm on the table. Like, then they're prepping me for surgery, which, you know, I'm like, I've already had a trach, you know, back in the day. So they had to go through that scar tissue and all this stuff. It was a little more complicated than.
Did you get trached like after a bar playing around, or did you like get trached while you were in combat?
No, that was actually when I was born, you know, I was like 17 months old. They don't know why, but that was my first kind of, you know, kind of challenge, I guess. Don't remember it, but this might have been SIDS or who knows. You know, they don't know why. I'm not allergic to anything.
Well, welcome back to another episode of the show. We've been hanging out here talking with Chris Cathers, a former U.S. Army Green Beret and CIA paramilitary global response staff contractor with 12 deployments to Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, and North Africa. He is a turnaround specialist and operating expert with over 15 years of experience in the manufacturing, defense, and service industries. Chris, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. We like to kick these things off with a bit of an icebreaker. Obviously, we're chatting with you there for a few minutes, but our icebreaker today from our Patreons, they ask you, what does the perfect burger look like? If you can make the perfect hamburger, what does it look like for you?
For me? Well, I'd have to go with, there's a place local here in Atlanta, and it's called a Buford Blue. Buford is one of the towns, but has blue cheese on it. That's kind of one of my things. So I'd have to say like some kind of blue cheese hamburger.
Man, I've on Instagram, I follow these like hamburger sites that these people just make these. My throat.
We're going to get a cheeseburger after
my
this.
My throat's starting to seize up a little bit. Yeah, man, they'll make these. I can't even describe them to you. It's almost, you got to see it. I mean, it's like smash burgers, and they smash the onions and the mushrooms, and they're like five patties, and the cheese comes. It's those pretzel buns with bacon. God almighty. Oh, my God. We're going to Ron's. You want to go to Ron's after this?
Yeah.
All right.
Have y'all had Tejas' cheeseburgers yet from the Tejas Burger Joint?
Yeah.
Well, they're really
good. Those are also good.
Miss Kitty's has the best. You know, when you bite into it, you got to clean your arms with a towel afterwards. Like one of those kind of grill burgers.
I'm a triple meat, diner. Triple cheese, bacon, jalapeno, grilled onion guy from Whataburger normally.
Yeah, I'm a number two from Whataburger. Shredded cheese, all the veggies.
I think cheeseburgers get a bad rap, man. It's got everything you need on it. It's got all your vegetables, some bread, meat,
dairy,
everything growing boy needs,
which,
man.
Is that's
great,
right.
Great for somebody in the 40s that just...
Metabolism is... Superb.
How old are you now, Chris?
I'm going to be 49 in August. I don't like to admit it anymore. You know, I tell people, I saw this like meme the other day, and I just totally relate to it. It was like, you know, when I wake up in the morning, I make all the sounds of like a glow stick, you know, the cracking and popping, but I don't glow. There's like no...
An infrared one?
Yeah. I'm like an infrared glow stick, you know, in the morning.
That's what you should say. That's what you say to your wife. She's like, you're not glowing. I'm infrared.
Yeah, trust me. There's a light in here, hon. It's just subdued. Absolutely, man. Dude, that's funny you do that because there's been a couple of times when I get up in the morning and sound like an old hot rod firing up with a busted something in the trunk. Right? And my wife, bless her, I'm like, babe, if you could have seen me in my prime, man, I move quick, front flip out of bed, hit the toilet in midair while I was going to the shower. Now it sounds...
sound like an old Buick firing up.
Well, once you get going, though, stand
hard
by.
Hard to stop,
man.
I watch Over the Fire Cooking. Oh. Watch that dude.
Yeah.
He makes some cheeseburgers and make you jump up, hit somebody.
That primitive cooking style, that stuff is real cool.
It is. Absolutely. I'll get online every now and again and watch.
You live out in the woods?
Street food watching.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, not as much as I'd like to. I mean, my goal, you know, in a perfect world would be to get a non-working farm, you know? And
those two words really don't go together, but I understand what you're trying to say.
Where it goes is I just want to be like fooling around on the back 40, you know, on a four wheeler, cutting trees down and, you know, that's, you know, maintaining and battling entropy. But I think I've already thought the process out. I'd like to have some goats. I hate goats, but I'd like to have like maybe four of them. And one of those would be a fainting goat or myotonic, they call them like myotonic goats. They fall over.
We had a sleeping goat. Yeah, we had them.
Do you have one?
Yeah, we have a bunch of them.
See, I would just bring buddies over, have a couple beers, you know, have a couple drinks, and you get an air horn, and you're like, hey, try to pick out which one of those is the fainting goat, you know? And you're just like, meh, you know? Maybe that's not cool to say anymore. Maybe it's like animal cruelty.
Nah, you're good.
Oh, that's the best thing. That's what I do now. Cattle rancher, farmer. I mean, it's going through all that madness that we had to go through in the beginning. It's almost as that's the only direction to go for peace. It's calming. Get up in the morning, yeah, man, walk around. That's all you got to do is deal with the animals.
Yeah. It's just, you know, I think you guys posted a picture. I saw something on social media about deer in the back, you know, there's something just really calming to your point, you know, about being in the country. Like I think about 6 months after my surgery, I spent some time up in the mountains in the Northeast, and it was amazing, man. I saw, you know, every day there'd be bears, you know, black bears and deer, and a little bit of everything, you know, and it just makes you feel more kind of at ease, you know. It's like where you're supposed to be.
Yeah, it's hard. It's great living out here. So let's start from where you're from and how you got to where you sitting today. Were you born and raised in Atlanta or in Georgia?
No, I call myself I'm a reformed Yankee. I claim the South now because I've lived most of my life down South, but I was born and raised in a small town about 45 minutes north of Philadelphia. It's called Doylestown. So that's kind of where my people came from. And, you know, that's where I was born and I'll be buried up there. But aside from that, I just love the South, you know. But yeah, I was raised by my father. I've got an older sister, an older brother, and then I've got a younger brother. And, you know, my parents got divorced when I was six. So my dad kind of raised me and he kind of had a profound impact. Actually, today's the fifth day of his, passed away in 2017 from cancer, ironically. But he joined the military in 1960 and then he was a military police. He was an MP from 1960 to 1964. Then he joined the Doylestown Police Department and was a canine handler from 64, I think, to 69. And then he was a sheriff for about 25 years. So he spent about 40 years in law enforcement. So in between that and the military, and that kind of led me to take some of the path that I ended up taking, I think.
Play sports in high school?
Yeah, I was a really good athlete growing up. You know, I did a little bit of everything. I mean, I started Taekwondo when I was like seven, you know, and then I did soccer just for a year or so, basketball, a couple years of football, even though my little brother says I didn't because he played college football. But yeah, then I got into running in eighth grade. You know, I broke the mile when I was in eighth grade, and it just was like, it came, I won't say natural to me because it was really hard, but I started doing that three seasons a year from eighth grade all the way through my senior year. So I was like just a long distance runner. I did the mile, 2 mile were kind of my events. I was better at the 2 mile, and I was kind of running somewhere around the 9:30 mark, you know, in 11th grade for the 2 mile. And I think that mindset kind of helped me. Huh?
All right. I know a little bit about, I don't know. 9:30 for a 2 miler.
Yeah.
How tall are you?
What's that?
How tall are you?
Well, I'm shrinking.
How tall you used to be?
I was 6 foot. I think I'm like 5'11", 5'11 and a half now, you know.
9:30, 2 miles.
That's trucking it, man. That's moving out.
Impressive.
So you like to run.
Yeah. It was kind of love hate, you know, like it was something that, there was a lot of mental aspect about it, you know, like, I was like Prefontaine. I wasn't the strongest guy or the fastest guy genetically. It was just a lot of, you know, that's why I like the 2 mile, because it was long enough where sometimes I'd let guys, I've been lapped before and had to catch up, you know, and it was just this mind game the whole time, you know, but, my coach kept me, that's what kept me in high school, to be honest with you. Academically, I was very smart. I was a good kid, but I got in a lot of trouble with like law enforcement when I was young and in high school. Got my dad, my own father actually arrested me in high school once. he put me in handcuffs. So
what was that like?
Memorable. It was funny. The guy
I can see your face, so I know you don't have to answer that. That look. This says so much to guys like us.
Yeah.
When you get an apex predator wide eyed like that,
it wasn't good. And it was front page of the newspaper because we were in a small town, and my dad was a sheriff. You know, and looking back, I mean, what an embarrassment. You know, as a kid, you know, to do that. As I'm more mature now, but back then I wasn't very mature, obviously, but. It wasn't good. I had to go to court. Luckily it didn't, I got everything, you know, off the record so I could join the military and kind of pursue something positive. But that's what, you know, sports kept me going, man, because if it wasn't for sports, like I just knew I had to make sure I was eligible every year. And I love sports so much that it just kind of kept me on the right path. But it wasn't a good scenario. The guy who actually the police that showed up, I knew the guy because he came over to like our cookouts and stuff. I had tons of cops at my house all the time, and he knew me, and he knew my dad. He used to be a deputy for him, and I was like, "Hey, you can arrest me, man. Just don't call my old man. Like he's gonna murder me." And he's like, "I gotta call your dad, dude." And he showed up and he was not happy, as you can imagine.
That's the worst, man.
Did you go to play sports in college? Or did you go straight in the Army after high school?
Well, the story goes, like, I had three options. My father, being in the military before, he knew I needed a kick in the butt. I also knew I needed a kick in the butt, you know, having those types of run-ins and, I had three options. It was either go to school, you know, go to college. I had scholarship opportunities, but not full. And I knew I wouldn't have done well in college. I just wasn't academically, it didn't do anything for me. Or I could get a job or join the military. So literally within a few days, I went down to MEPS and I didn't do any due diligence. The internet wasn't big back then. And, I joined for 6 years, the late entry program, right off the bat, right out of high school. And
good for you. You know, I went just jumped in there, huh?
What's it?
Just jumped in there. Give me the 6 year. You got a 10 year billet?
Yeah, I came home and told my father that, and he goes, "Dude, really? Like 6 years?" I meant like maybe like three, you know. And I didn't know what I wanted to do at the time, right? Like, because I didn't know, you know, I grew up watching. I think one of the influences, this is going to sound kind of cheesy, especially guys in the community, but like, you know, I used to watch the old Rambo, the original one.
Why is that cheesy?
Yeah, it was
dude,
just
that
like,
defined us. What are you talking about? That, that was awesome.
Yeah, we played Rambo. They didn't have Navy SEALs back in them days.
Man, I walk around with that survival knife.
Compound bow.
Compound bow said Rambo over the top of it, man. It's not a, we, and Commando. I thought Commando was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was on the other day.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. The movies that those 80s movies that defined our generation. I mean, it's almost like right we were coming up right when those wars were spinning off. And all that, those types of movies that we watch, man, I'm telling you, thank God we had them.
That scene on the mountain when that cop's like, those Green Berets, they're real badasses.
They're real badasses. I mean, Stallone hooked y'all up. He freaking hooked y'all up, man. Old school for CGI. That dude bailed off side of that.
Anyway, go ahead.
Sorry, man. That little shout out of you greeny beanies.
Yeah, well, you guys took over all the. You guys got all the cool movies now.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You're right.
You know, but yeah, that was my. I got screwed by a recruiter story, right? So I went in and I said, I didn't know what anything was. You know, I didn't really understand.
I bet that guy loved you, man. Those recruiters, oh, yeah, guys like you walk
yeah,
in.
Yeah, 6 years. What can I do more? Like, can
dude,
I just
he probably got a trip to Hawaii.
I didn't get anything. I said, he goes, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be an airborne ranger. I didn't even know what ranger school was all about at that point, you know? And he
what
goes,
year is this? I'm sorry to interrupt. What year was this?
96?
That was 1992.
Yep,
back in the day. And he goes, okay, airborne qualified. He stamped my paper. I saw airborne qualified. I didn't know what that meant. It just meant I was qualified to go to airborne school. I didn't get airborne school. And I actually went in as a soft skill MOS. I was a 68 X-ray, which was, you know, I worked on Apaches, a farthest thing from, you know, going to Ranger Battalion or SF that you could be, right? So that kind of presented challenges down the road because when I got to my, when I went in, I started to excel because I enjoyed the process. You know, after I got out of basic, I kind of started to like figure things out. So when I was an E4, I was like, all right, I want to go to Ranger school. And they said, you can't go to Ranger school, man. You're not a combat MOS. You're not an 11 Bravo. You don't have any background. And I was like, man, okay, well, what can I do? They said, you can be a Green Beret. And I was like, all right, let's do that. So in 1995, I went to selection. I was in Germany at the time and I was a corporal. So I was young, inexperienced, and went through selection. And all they told me was like, hey, if you don't quit, the probability of you getting selected is very high. And that's all I knew. And everybody else, a lot of guys were coming from Ranger Battalion, 11 Bravos. You know, they had a lot more experience. So selection process was rough, but, you know, physically, I was a runner. I had a lot of good physical advantages. But so I went through just fine. And then after airborne school, I went back to my unit, went to airborne school and started the Q course. And I know, Marcus, you're an 18 Delta. So that's what I thought I wanted to do, right? Well, they didn't think I was smart enough to do that. I was an 18 Bravo. I was a weapon sergeant.
Don't worry. I didn't think I was smart enough either. Freaking courses. Impossible.
I don't think I would.
But don't get me wrong. I love being a bastard to the Army guys. I mean, it's paid off so many times having that qual. God, back it up to when you're talking about going into selection, when it's like, hey, man, just don't quit. Because I think about that now that we're older, and you got those young guys in there, man, and I'm starting to remember what I felt like before I went in, how cool that was. I think that's the best part about when we get older. It's like you start to look back and reflect, like, oh, yeah, man. I because the old timers, the Vietnam guys would come up to us and be like, man, you guys are badass at what you're doing. You're freaking rock and rolling. And they'd be like, man, we think that about you guys. That you guys kind of paved the way, man. We're just in here starting to widen that thing a little bit. But
yeah,
because I remember walking into selection the first time, or they're like, hey, man, all you do is just don't quit. I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
Yeah, me neither.
I had no idea the depth of where we were what was going to happen. And then you just like you have to think about that never quitting stuff all the time.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Because I mean, every freaking day someone was crushing your soul. I mean, one of my instructors, I was like, he had that red pen He's like, my job is to spend all the ink on that paper. I can't. I'm going to make this sucker bleed like it was red paper. And I wasn't even there. I was trying to become a medic. Or, you know, I was supposed to be there. That was cool. But it didn't matter. It automatically became a selection. If you're in that freaking program, there ain't no, it's easy. There's no lane like that. It's hard for everybody. Right.
Oh, yeah. Hard 100%. For everybody,
man. And you know what that does, yeah, man? That kicks out any kind of animosity. It's like every person had to go through that crap.
I think it's kind of an advantage in a way because, like, I knew I wouldn't quit. I was like, you're going to have to kill me to put me out of it. Like,
so that's what I said, too. Same thing.
I didn't want to go back to my unit and be that guy. You know, there's a lot of pressure because when you're leaving to go to selection, if you wash out, you got to go back to where you came from. If you're lucky. And those guys, you know, that's such a letdown. You know, I was like, man, I do not want to go through that. So that kind of motivated me a little bit. But also when people quit, it was like I kind of fed off that energy. I love watching people break because it kind of was like, hey, that's one less guy I have to worry about. You know, I know a certain amount of people are going to make it.
I think that might have been a little bit of the intimidating part in the beginning, too, because you saw the guys that washed out. Like, normally they quit when you're not looking, but there were some that would you be like, man, dude, I thought for sure that guy was.
And then they make a show out of it.
They make a show out of it. So you kind of.
Yeah.
That's why we learn to keep moving.
Right.
It kind of takes what presents some problems when we become a civilian. You know, when in any other kind of capacity, you want to show that nerd. But with us, it's like, hey, man, because quitting is an option.
But, yep.
Yeah, so I guess in the back of our head, we know that. But if you focus on it, then, man, it'll consume you. We just kept going to the point to where it's so ingrained in us. Anytime I talk about this when I'm on stage, I'm like, hey, man, every time somebody tells us to quit something, we block you out.
Yep.
Our instructors would say that to us. While guys were dying. I'm like, no, I don't want to quit. Why? Where else am I going to go? I got nothing else. I can't go anywhere else. It's like, well, I always treated it like that.
Right.
Like, I was there. What the hell else am I going to do?
Yeah. And like you said, one of the things that was weird back when I went through was like, you could go through that, like every week they would have, I can't remember if it was every week or how often. I think it was like, there was a couple of different times where they'd line you up and no matter what, nobody's quit. You made it through. They did it all the way to the last day. They'd say, all right, group one to my left, group two to your right. And you'd be watching each guy, like you're just saying, and there were some studs going in group one. And then you're like, man, then you go to group two and you're like, oh man, you start looking left and right. And they're like, hey, group one, you're all no-goes. You're out of here. And for, you know, you can get peered out or,
right.
You know, there's no rationale. You don't know what the rationale was, but you're like, man, that guy's a stud. And then I'm in this other group and you're like, I'm not sure if I'm going to be that guy. And that's terrifying because there's nothing you can do about it. You know what I mean?
Bro, back in the day, man, they kick your ass out if you were ugly. I mean, we had guys who pull up and panic confusion out of sequence. That's all you had to say, man. Because if they didn't like your ass, which is the teams.
Right.
So that's the thing. That peer evaluation is important. You want to stick somebody in there that can't jive with everybody. And they know that. You don't know what it's a student.
Been in trouble.
I mean, because think about that. When you have a student mentality, that's completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a different kind of human walking around. Student mentality.
Right.
I didn't really put all that together. And somebody explained to me, like when we start, we don't grow up fast. We just get big fast. Growing up kind of takes a while. So, but when we start something like school, from when you start kindergarten, you graduate high school, man, you're a different human being altogether. When you start college and you graduate, we classify you as a different type of person. And the same holds true, like people who start as a white belt as opposed to when they're a black belt. They look the same, man, but what's inside that sucker is different.
Right.
And when we joined SF is when it really came into play. And the minute someone acknowledged that, like that's how that works. Someone has to acknowledge it. You can call yourself whatever you want all damn day. But the minute our people throw a title on you, it's completely different. Because when you start selection, when you got tabbed up, you know, and that never goes away. It's almost as if when they put that pin on you, acknowledge that, it ingrains and you've reconnected some kind of wire to a different program. and it never goes away.
Yeah, and it's funny because I had more problems like as I went through the Q course than I did with selection because, like I said, I didn't have a background. They were talking about all the vernacular, the terms and terminology that they were using. I didn't have any of that background, like small unit tactics. When we went out to the, you know, to do phase one, I was like, I was totally green. And a lot of guys would help you out, you know, which was nice. If you're a good dude, some guys would help try to like educate you off time, the little bit of, that you had. But that and land nav, man, land nav kicked my ass. I got recycled land nav. All I did was run. I probably, if you watch me on a screen, I probably covered three times the distance of anybody else because I was such an idiot. You know,
I was just covering your bases. That's all, so, bro. I don't worry about it.
You went
making sure no one was following you.
I must have missed it. You went to Q course and you went to a SF group. Then you went over to CAG.
No, so I went through after I finished. SF, I got out right before it was in the fall of 99 going into 2000. So I made the decision to get out.
Like what month?
Huh?
What month? I mean, I was right at the, when we were transitioning over 2000, I came in March 99.
It was
98.
Probably that fall. It was like, maybe October, I think somewhere around there is when I got out. And then I went to PA school because I wanted to be like Marcus, you know, they told me I was too stupid to be a medic. So I was like, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll be a PA. Yeah. So I almost finished, you know, I went back to Pennsylvania. I went to a university up there. I did 2 years at a community college to kind of get assimilated. And that was a hard transition being with, mm-hmm. with young kids. I was only like 20, late 20s, but
Mojo did that.
What's that?
He did that. When he went back to school,
yeah,
had an older
age. I was in my 40s, it sucked.
Yeah, it was super rough, super rough. I'm just looking left and right. There's a lot of 18, 20-year-olds. I'm just like, man, I'm just starting again, and I don't have anything in common with anybody, you know? And 9-11 happened. I was getting ready to take a biology test that morning, and as soon as that happened, that threw me in the whole other direction again. I had about 5 classes left to finish my biology pre-PA course. And I called my team sergeant that day. It was like all 9-11. I said, hey, I want to come back. And he's like, ah, dude, by the time you get back in, this is going to be over, this and that. So I, you know, waited another month or two. And then a buddy of mine, one of my best friends, hit me up and he was like, hey dude, they're recruiting for OGA. You know, he was in Afghanistan at the time. And he's like, you want to come do that work? You know, they're recruiting. And I'm like, 100%, dude. I didn't even miss a beat. And I started right after that, went through the vetting process and early days. And I was in Iraq by right around a month after the invasion, somewhere around there. So
really?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Real fast.
It was awesome. You know, back awesome, in 2003, right? it was good. Because it was what I wanted to do previously. It was like the Wild West. There wasn't a lot of bureaucracy. You know what I mean?
None, right?
Just like run and gun. You're on the road every day.
Yeah.
And it was just a different atmosphere. That's what I really wanted to do. And I feel like I've been a protector my whole life, like a sheepdog. You know, I just want to keep the wolves at bay. I like the putting someone else, you know, we were doing high risk protection for government assets. So I really enjoyed, you know, protecting people, you know, in hostile environments and austere environments. So I loved 03 was great. It was quiet. We were riding soft skin vehicles, but then I went back in January. I think, I don't know what month it was. It was probably right after maybe January. I had a month home. I went back in early 2004 again, and it just got crazy then, you know, like it just went, you know, we were getting, there was a lot of incidences at that time.
Where were we all out of?
Originally, like I was everywhere. At Biap, like the Baghdad International Airport, mm-hmm. we were set up there. Then we went to Camp Slayer. So yeah, that's kind of where we were at the time. And then we just punch out from there, you know, Mosul, Ramadi, you know, Sadar City, wherever we got to go.
Wonderful places. Thought about buying the property there.
Wonderful.
So nice.
How long were you in OGA?
I did that till 06. So after Iraq, I went to Afghanistan, did a couple stints there. And then I went to Israel for, I like to say a year, but it wasn't a full year. I just tried to stay there as much as possible because it was a much better environment, you know, compared to where I had been. And I kind of enjoyed it. It was kind of like, it's kind of like the appreciation tour, you know.
Cool place.
Yeah, it was awesome, man. You know, like Jerusalem is a really awesome town. There's just so much history there. I just enjoyed the history, you know. There's so much, it's such a rich, you know, history.
So moved out of OGA, you were ODA, OGA, retired out in 06, and then where'd that take
you? Then I went, I kind of took it, you know, I got hit by a couple IEDs early on, and my ex-wife at the time was like, hey, you know, your number's coming, man. And I was trying to think, like, I'm like, look, I didn't, we kept saying that the war was going to be over in a year, then in 2 years, 3 years. Had I known it was going to go on as long as it did, I probably would have tried to continue on. But I thought it was going to dry up, you know, and I was starting to think to the future because I'm like, well, it's a young man's game, you know. I was in my mid-30s, still young. So I got into defense contracting. My buddy, John Zinn, was in SEAL Team 3. We were partners in I was introduced to him when I was in Iraq in 03 and 04. And he did a startup with an armored vehicle company. So one of the problems we were having was we were driving a lot of armored vehicles. The government was scrambling to get all these vehicles overseas, but they wouldn't blend. So we would just get hit all the time, you know, like, hey, there's a Suburban, there's a, you know, a 7 Series BMW,
right?
You know, that's armored, which is great, but you need that armor because you know you're going to get hit. So we wanted to go make indigenous vehicles that would blend in the environments that they were operating in. So I initially invested in the company, and it, probably around 04, well, maybe it was 05, but, I have eventually came in as a PM. I didn't know anything about the industry. I got my business degree, Six Sigma Lean courses that were automotive focused, project management courses. And yeah, I was with that company until 2011. Well, actually like late 2010, because he ended up passing away on a business trip. And it really, that's what started the whole, you know, that kind of catapulted me into some mental health issues. You know, as I look back, I didn't know this at the time until recently, actually. But his death was just, it was unexpected. For one, he was only like 32, 33 years old. And there was just a series of unfortunate events surrounding that. Like, I had to tell his wife, who was about 9 months pregnant with his first boy. They lived in my neighborhood. We were like the mafia, you know, we all had these, a lot of us were all in the same neighborhood. So he was a huge influence on me, you know, like we challenged each other and just worked to the bone. And I had to tell his wife, you know, which was just one of the hardest things I've had to do. And he had two daughters at the time. And it was just, that whole year was just tough. And we even had to pick his body up in my buddy's Suburban and drive him from the airport, because he died in Jordan, and we had to drive him up. And then, you know, his father was a Vietnam veteran, and our legal counsel, he wanted to open up the casket, and it was just a, you know, we're crowbarring this casket open, and it was just it just had a long impact on me for a lot of reasons. But in hindsight, I managed to get like, that's where, you know, the best stuff. I had some issues with anxiety previous to that. Like, I didn't want to be in any social settings. If you asked me 2 years ago to do a podcast like this, there's no possible way I could have done it. I just was terrified to be in front of people, leave the house. You know, I just go to the gym and the grocery store. That's my thing, you know, and I'm still kind of a hermit, but that kind of like pushed, I ended up running another armored vehicle company after that, 6 months after, but I was starting to drink a lot. And I tried holistic ways to combat my anxiety and depression. Like I would work out, started at one a day, which I normally do. And then I went to 2-a-days, the 3-a-days. I was working out because if I redline my body, then all the noise would settle down, if that makes sense. And I got more and more, the more I did it, the more resistance I had to being able to redline myself. You know, I was training with like some high level athletes doing like, at that time, a lot of MMA type style workouts, like functional fitness. And I got down to 170 pounds. So I was super like just wearing myself out. But then I'd come home and drink like, you know, a fifth, or I was taking Vicodin, Percocet, whatever I get my hands on. Cause then I would have, it was a temporary fix to a solution, you know, temporary solution. And so I ended up going on to another armored vehicle company for 5 years. And like, I don't even remember the interview. I was interviewed 5 times because I was running the US armored vehicle business for a company called Jankel. Great company, made armored vehicles as well. We supplied them to the US government, but I don't even remember my interview, you know. And I just had like anger issues, just, you know, I get easily agitated where I'd just go off, which obviously isn't conducive to a work environment, right? When you're leading a high pressured expansion in trying to take over the US armored, you know, vehicle business for the US. So then I came to Georgia for another company. In the last 5 years, I got back into private security. I wanted to do, you know, I was like, look, I want to run and gun and one more go, you know? And so I got back into doing high risk protection for celebrities last 5 years up to when my cancer diagnosis.
Anybody
so
that's cool?
What's that?
Anybody cool?
Well, unfortunately, I'm under NDAs. But yeah, it was just
that means they were all cool.
Yeah, real variety cool. Of people, you know.
They're all cool up there, man. That's why they're the stars.
I'm not really that starstruck, you know, with folks in general. I'm like, everyone's just the dude, you know. But I like the mission, you know. That's what got me back into it. I was like, I just want to do this. Maybe I can do it to 50, you know. Just because physically I was really still really fit. And I just enjoy it. You know, it's kind of like, I felt like a Ronin when I was in the manufacturing space. It's like, I had the purpose there, but doing something bigger than you, I feel like has always been a calling for me, you know?
Sure. Yeah. It's ingrained that DNA. Like, it doesn't matter what you call us or what kind of generation that we're in, guys, certain type of guys generate to a certain path.
100%.
So given just your path, in your experiences and now in your diagnosis with cancer and your battle with cancer, but you got your documentary that you got coming up?
Yeah. So earlier this year in January, so what ended up happening when I got my cancer diagnosis in the fall of 19, and it was a fairly advanced form of bone cancer. So I knew initially my outlook wasn't particularly great, you know, 29% 5-year survival to start wasn't good. So I started getting treatment for PTS. I got, you know, medicated and actually was very diligent. Like I haven't missed a meeting in almost 2 years, and that started to help. So that kind of prompted me when I knew I had lung cancer last year. I wasn't diagnosed officially, but I knew I was stage 4. I said, man, I've been watching the news for the last 3 years as I'm rehabbing, and our country is very sick right now. There's a sickness in our country. It's very obvious. If you don't even have to think about it to know there's just a big issue in our country. And it pained me because I'm a patriot and I love our country. I think we have the best country on the planet, but we're doing our best and our damnedest to fuck it up. And it's not acceptable to me. So I wanted to do something again while I'm going through all these treatments and figuring I only had maybe a year to live. I was like, I want to do something impactful and I want to do something positive in light of all this stuff that's going on in our country. Every time you turn on a news channel, it's the next book of Revelations. And I started recalling documentary guys. I have no idea what I'm doing in regards to documentary. I have not done a film or book or anything. I stayed away from it my whole career. And I found my my partner, he's my producer for the documentary, Daniel Beatty. I ended up reaching out to him. He was very passionate about this. We've self-funded the last 6 months we've been filming. And the whole purpose of what we're doing, I wanted to raise awareness of the epidemic of veteran suicide in our community. And it's bigger than our community, but that's people that I can get in front of a lot easier than just the general populace. But it's a big health epidemic across the board, paramedics, firefighters, first responders, and regular people. But when I saw the numbers, estimated in 2021, Boston University, the last numbers I got in 2021, it was over 30,177 veterans have committed suicide post 9/11. And we had 70,000 combat losses or 7,057 combat losses at that time. And I was like, holy shit. And that's just people that are active duty or veterans of the post 9/11 wars. But if you look at 22 a day, you're talking somewhere around 150,000 people around that number have committed suicide just from 2001. And I wanted to do something about it. I was like, if I can save one life, if I struggled, I'm a professional sufferer. And when I started the documentary, I told my buddy, I said, hey, I don't know if I'm going to make it through the end of this documentary, dude. I had suicidal ideation like daily for, off and on, but at some points daily, all day. And I was like, I'm going to end up losing this battle, man. So if I can't do it, how about other dudes, that might not be as equipped. And so we set out on this. So I wanted to tell my story, but I also have these exceptional veterans in the community that have found ways to get past it. And I wanted to take an approach was aspiring, not like, a sad documentary, which it is really grim. Like, who's going to tune in to watch a documentary on veteran suicide? It's kind of grim, but I inspire people through my story and these other guys who a lot of amputees burned over 70% of their bodies, and they come through the other side and are doing these exceptional things. So that's kind of the goal, and I also want to provide true resources so guys know where to look at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's important.
When's that coming out?
So we got about 80% of the filming portion done. We've self-funded everything to date. So we've flown out to Texas, to your neck of the woods, done a bunch of interviews there, a couple in Nashville. We just got back from Savannah and Nashville within the last month, Oklahoma. So up to this point, we've got about 80% of the film done. We're targeting January, for a release. And that's going to be predicated on funding, because we're going to need help on the post-editing work is where a lot of work, the work has to be done. So we're about that point. We got about maybe 15 to 20% left of the film, maybe another month. And then we got to get right into post-work. So yeah, that's kind of what our goal is.
Well, what's next? What's next for Chris? I mean, you're definitely a optimist and a
long sufferer.
Yeah. But you're also, you got a clock. I don't think anybody could walk around. I don't think anybody could be as optimistic as you're walking around with a clock hanging around their neck.
Yeah.
What's the secret?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you guys a personal one. That's kind of like hits home really hard right now. Right. Cause I wrote Andrew, maybe about a week ago, we found out my wife was pregnant.
Congratulations. Man.
Well, yeah, I shouldn't have let in with that one. About 3 weeks ago, because it's going to go into the mindset, right? Because what you guys do, talk about not quitting. We went 9 years. We didn't think we could have children. One, I'm old as dirt and I'm stage 4, right? So we were not planning on having a child. But my wife... So we've been together for about 9 years, we've been raising an 18-year-old Gavin. He's a fantastic kid. just graduated high school. And so about 3 weeks ago, we found out she was pregnant. And I went, she didn't have anybody by her side with her pregnancy with him. She was pregnant at like 17 in high school, 18. So she raised him by herself. So fast forward to 3 weeks ago, I found out, I was like, she was obviously upset because of my diagnosis. I said, hey, guess I'll have to fucking try harder, right? I literally told her that, you know, I was like, hey man, only God's going to take me out at this point. This is meant to be. So it was kind of a mind fuck, you know, and a really horrible thing. It was like, you know, such a great blessing. And I just was like, man, this is like God's work, man, because chances. But then like, you know, I went through this not a week and a half ago. It was actually 2 weeks from today. Went and saw the baby's heartbeat, you know, which blew my mind because I'd never had my own kids biologically. And that was part of why I wanted to set up a nonprofit to do what we're doing and do this documentary. And just last week on Tuesday, we lost the baby, which was just horrible. Oh, and
You shouldn't have led with that.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it goes into the story, right? Like it was such a, like with all the things going on, the following day I started my cancer, you know, I had a lot of exploratory tests to be done the following day. So it was like all this stuff at one time. So we came home, she's still dealing with that. And we're both dealing with that. But when it comes to mindset, that day was, you know, so devastating. But at the same point, from a mindset perspective, I started having these thoughts creep in. This is important for the viewers because it's how you deal. It's all on how you frame what's going on in your life. And I was really pissed that day and just kind of angry at the world. You know, you start having these thoughts like, how's all this bad shit happening to me? Right. So the next morning I woke up when the doctor came in, she said, once my wife said something really profound. She was like, I didn't know how bad we wanted this until it happened, you know? And I was thinking the exact same thing. I'm like, well, number one, we know we can have a kid now. And number two, we both want to do it. So let's, you know, she wants to try. And I was like, hey, let's get through and figure out where I'm at with my cancer treatment and let's go. And that's what I latched onto. The following day, I totally changed my mindset and I fixated on that one positive thing. And even with my cancer stuff, I'm like, let's go, you know, like I'm ready to tackle on whatever challenge the doc gives me. You know, I'll probably get like all, you know, skinny and my beard will fall out. You know, it is what it is, you know.
Now that's so, the mindset right there.
I mean,
you can't do nothing else. You just got to go forward.
I'm trying to harness it in the good, you know, because we're doing good things with the documentary. I've already made it a year at stage four, you know, with no treatment. And I feel great. I go to the gym 5-6 days a week, trying to do all the right things. And you just got to get after it, you know, and just reframe your brain, you know, especially with PTS guys. Guys always are like, man, I grew up, I'm old school, man. My dad was, you know, I told you about my father being a cop and being a military. We weren't a touchy feely kind of, you know, relationship. And I've talked to friends who are suffering right now. And they're like, man, I don't want to talk about my feelings. I'm like, yeah, because it's fucking hard, dude. You know, that's what you need. You need to face it like an enemy. And the hardest enemy is yourself.
Sure.
Absolutely. You know,
and it's always good with guys like us too, man. You focus on something else. As soon as you get that task, reconnect that energy. You know, I mean, because that thinking about that, well, it'll burn a hole in you.
Yeah, for sure. If you let it, but you can't.
Yeah.
Chris, what can our listeners do to support you, support the documentary? Because obviously what you're doing is going to make a huge impact and what an incredible legacy. How can we support you?
Well, it's funny. The other thing is like, I hate, you know, on the help side, I hate to ask for help, you know what I mean? But the things that people can do, you know, one, we have a landing page up. It's We Are Brothers Keeper with an S. What we're looking for is like people can follow me on social media and follow kind of the journey of what we're doing. I'm trying to weaponize social media for good, and that's it. At least I'm attempting to.
What's your social media platforms?
I'm on Instagram. It's Chris_Cathers, C-A-T-H-E-R-S. And so basically the We Are Brothers landing page, we're going to start launching that now for donations to help us put together the remainder portion of our documentary. And I'm also setting up a 501(c) charity, and any money that's raised above and beyond our documentary, I want to start partnering with nonprofits that are truly doing good work, that are vetted. I've already flown out to several really awesome nonprofits or for-profit businesses that are helping veterans that are struggling with PTS, mental health issues, or suicide, or drug addiction, because there's a lot of similarities there. So that's what I want to do. I want to continue that 501(c) when we're finished the documentary, to continually raise funds and go 501(c) to 501(c) and help veterans in need. So that's kind of what we're doing.
And make babies.
Yes.
Definitely. Yeah, now you got to stick around and raise that kid. You ain't going nowhere.
Hey, man, that's a motivator, right?
Hey, man.
That's what that's for.
That's going to keep you alive for the next 50 years.
Then there'll be times you're like, what was I thinking?
Damn. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's all perspective, right? No matter what we're in, man, when you're in it, you kind of, it's always something. My brother and I were talking about this morning. We were driving around and it's like, hey, man, so and so is dealing with this or we're dealing with that. And I'm like, well, man, it's life in itself is a problem. If you're alive and you're in it, you're going to have one. So it's how you deal with it.
Yeah.
So you're a great example of that, man. So don't give up. Never quit, man. Just keep moving forward, brother. And we'll do everything we can to support you and back you up. Pass the word around.
Yeah, that's the other thing people can do is just spread the word, you know. If people on social media, you know, use it for good. And I think what we're doing is holistically good, you know. As far as a documentary, I really think people just talking about it, it's probably a close second to the hardest I've ever done is this documentary, because it's really highly uncomfortable to talk about, you know, things you've been through. But because I know it's for, you know, it's a bigger purpose than myself, it makes it a lot easier. And it's been a kind of a healing, you know, process through it. I had to do some pretty difficult things as we've been filming this, and even hearing other guys' stories, man, it's rough, because some of these guys are so exceptional. I'm like, you need a movie, dude. Like, some of these guys' stories are, you know, just so crazy. And I just want to help
everybody, man. If you went over in the body, they're all crazy.
It's nuts.
Not crazy, they're great. They're just great stories. I mean, even the hardcore ones, when you got guys sitting in there, because I think with our generation, man, that's what we were raised for. And the stories that come out of there, damn sure, man, they're on point.
Yeah. Bad decisions and bad days make great stories.
Yeah, PTSD, man, that's just pissed off, tired, looking for something to do, right? Get some PT in, stop drinking. There's just, you know, when you hear our guys, especially our generation, it's a thing we do. Like, everything that you talk about is like, each one of us had to go through that. It's the craziest damn thing. It's almost our rite of passage is just to be in this fraternity. It's like, hey, man, you remember that phase? People are like, hey, you quit drinking? I was like, no, I just drank all of it. There ain't nothing left. I drank till I got bored, I guess. I don't know, man. It just stopped. It's like each one of these phases in our life, we go through it, man. And well, here's the deal. Is the more we talk about it, everyone, you start to realize that. So then it's not an individual problem, man. It's like, all right, if we're all stuck in here doing this together, then there's a point to it. Because you can't believe what it'll create.
Yeah.
Some of us don't survive, some of us do, right? But as we're only midway through this. And look what we've already been through. I mean, look what they put us through. Us putting us through this. I mean, you don't get battle weakened, man. You get battle hardened. There's wisdom that comes with all that pain. You don't learn nothing unless you get out there and suffer.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that maybe it'll help if I say it, but, you know, there's this great quote that thief is the comparison of joy, or comparison is the thief of joy, right? And I think that it's so interesting because I know guys that I just look up to in the fact of some of the things they've accomplished, right? I'm like, who am I, you know? And I'm looking at these guys and they're some guys are so self-deprecating, you know? They compare themselves to other guys. And I've had it happen through the documentary. I have an amputee friend who's in the fight, you know, he's really struggling. And he's an amputee, below the knee amputee, but went through just a lot of stuff. And, you know, he'll be like, oh, but you did this and you did that. I'm like, dude, this isn't about me, bro. You know, I look at you and I put you on a pedestal because of the stuff that you've been through. You just need to deal with it. And you got to go, you know, it's so crazy.
Deal with it, damn it.
Yeah, you can't compare yourself, you know, to anybody else. You just got to do you.
Keep it right on, bro.
Chris, thanks so much, man, for sharing your story with us. And we'll definitely be sure to let the audience know where they can support you. We'll put the links in the bio so people can find everything you're doing, follow you on social, support the documentary. So thank you again for sharing that.
Yeah, brother. Thanks a lot, man. We need to get you out here,
yeah,
too.
Thank you. Yeah.
Hey, keep us posted on what's going on with you.
Yeah, no, 100%. I will. I should know more by the end of this week. You know, it's an exciting week because I just want to get some answers and get on with it. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah,
right. You know? Can we get your contact info from Andrew? Send it over.
Yeah, I'll punch it out to you guys.
I'll hit you up.
Cell phone number, man. We'll keep in touch.
If you need anything on the medical side or whatever, well, I'm getting pretty connected these days. So
Doc
maybe.
Frankenstein, we got one of them guys. I mean, you know, whatever you want to do, bro.
We got everything in this club. You can't believe it.
That's awesome.
We'll keep you in our prayers, man.
Guys.
Yeah, we'll keep praying for you, bro, and just keep charging for it.
100%. Yeah, I appreciate you guys. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right, buddy. Adios.